Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The Mueller report overshadowed pretty much everything this week. President Trump says he's totally and completely vindicated based on his attorney general's four-page summary, but that's not quite right. The full findings of the report, which runs at least 300 pages, remain a mystery. And House Democrats, including Maryland's Jamie Raskin, say, hold the phone.
It's a public document. It has to be turned over. And we did have this unanimous bipartisan vote that it must be turned over as quickly as possible. But as the week goes on, it just seems like the smell of a whitewash and a cover-up is getting thicker and thicker.
While taking his Mueller victory lap, Trump goes all in on an issue that arguably cost the GOP in the 2018 midterm elections, setting his sights against Obamacare.
Let me just tell you exactly what my message is. The Republican Party will soon be known as the party of health care. You watch.
And then there's Chicago's Mayor Rahm Emanuel, furious and fuming over the prosecutor's decision to drop 16 felony charges against actor Jussie Smollett.
This is without a doubt a whitewash of justice and sends a clear message that if you're in a position of influence and power, you'll get treated one way. Other people will be treated another way. There is no accountability then in the system. It is wrong. Full stop.
Claims of whitewash in the Windy City and in Washington. We'd like you to join us here on Folkenflik Friday. What conclusions do you draw from what we've learned so far about the Mueller report? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington is Sungmin Kim. She's White House reporter for The Washington Post. Sungmin, great to have you back with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, David.
Also delighted to have with us from Washington, Seth Mandel. He's a writer and executive editor of The Washington Examiner magazine. Seth Mandel, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point's own news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Seth, and Sungmin.
Well, the attention has been on the president for a while, and I guess we might as well let him have the first word on the show. He declared total exoneration, complete victory during a rally in Grand Rapids, Michigan last night, saying that after 3 years of, quote, lies and smears and slander, the Russia hoax is finally dead.
The collusion delusion is over. The special counsel completed its report and found no collusion and no obstruction. I could have told you that 2.5 years ago very easily.
The collusion delusion is over. We haven't seen that sort of rhyme scan since the Reverend Jesse Jackson was running in 1988. The president feels it's a good moment. Want to read briefly to remind listeners about what the attorney general said in his summary of Special Counsel Mueller's report. He quoted the report stating, quote, the investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. And on the question of obstruction of justice, the attorney general wrote that the special counsel states that, quote, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. Seth Mandel, how good a moment is this for President Trump?
Well, it's pretty good because the underlying point here, the collusion is something that that's a cloud that he's definitely happy to be out from underneath for sure. But it's I don't think it's an exoneration, and I think the president should temper his excitement. But a part of that is because I think there's something lurking in the report that's going to change people's impressions of what Attorney General Barr said, but more because Democrats on committees in the House are going to be calling hearings and there's going to be other investigations. And so there's plenty of grist for the mill here. And this is not going to end the whole process. And part of the frustration of the president and many people in his circle and in the White House has been that they feel bogged down by this, that it's sort of chaining them to this day-to-day drama over something that happened 2 years ago or didn't happen 2 years ago, and it's getting in the way of their messaging and their ability to conduct policy, both foreign and domestic. And so I would caution the president to keep in mind that that part of it is not going away.
So you're saying that it's not as though the cloud lifts and suddenly the president, the administration can say, great, we're going to be policy focused, we're going to be election focused, and, you know, it'll be, you know, we'll be evaluated on our merits aside from this scandal.
Right. Yeah, it's still going to weigh them down a bit. The collusion part is a big deal, but this is going to be an ongoing process.
Sungmin, you know, you covered the White House. You also, you know, have an intense focus on the interplay that the White House has with Capitol Hill. What are you hearing up there from not just Democrats, but from Republicans about how this is being evaluated?
So obviously the big story is the Democrats, I mean, particularly in the House where they have control. And the main focus, the kind of the next stage of this fight when it comes to the Mueller report, is really actually getting that report. The Democrats, after the conclusions that they came out over the weekend from the Attorney General, really said, well, you know, this is just four pages. The Attorney General came to this pretty quick. We need to see the entire report. Now, there are obviously definitely considerations that the Attorney General is undertaking right now, you know, making sure to redact grand jury information, redacting other information that may compromise sources and methods. But Democrats have made it clear they want to see everything, the entire report, the underlying evidence, because they want to scrub basically every part of the investigation that they can to make sure that essentially to scrub every part of the information possible. Now, Republicans, there have been kind of two ways that congressional Republicans have greeted the Mueller report. There are some of his most ardent allies in the House have been as effusive as the president, you know, saying no collusion, no obstruction, you know, all the things that the president essentially said at his rally last night. But if you look at the comments from particularly Senate Republicans, they've been very obviously they've welcomed the summary of the findings so far.
Let me just dash in on this, Sungmin, because I want to play for you a couple of clips that I think evoke what you're talking about. Yesterday, the House Speaker, Democratic leader in the House, Nancy Pelosi, called on the Attorney General, William Barr, to, you know, deliver the full report to Congress.
We have to see the facts. We have to see what the report is. And we do not need an Attorney General whose job interview was that the president is above the law, that doesn't think a president can be indicted, to be our interpreter of something that he should just show us.
And on Fox News yesterday, Senator Lindsey Graham, the head of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, said that Pelosi's criticism was beneath her.
Do you really believe that Bob Barr would give us a summary of the key findings and it not be supported by the report? Give me a break. I mean, this whole Oliver Stone approach to the Mueller report by Democrats is getting a bit old.
A little slip of the tongue there by Senator Graham. He's referring to actually means to say Bill Barr. Bob Barr was his old colleague among the impeachment managers of Bill Clinton about 20 years ago. But Sungmin, briefly, you know, is there the sense that essentially Republicans are going to actively work to try to prevent the full report from getting up there on the Hill? Or do they share it in the way that was reflected in a unanimous vote in the House just some days ago?
Well, Republicans are kind of aligning behind what the Attorney General has indicated, which he indicated during his confirmation hearings, and he has indicated again since, that he's going to release as much of the report as possible, as allowed by the law. Now, there are caveats there, clearly, some of the caveats that we discussed earlier, but for Democrats, that explanation is not enough, and they want to see the entire thing, which is why, despite that 420-0 vote that we saw in the House just a couple of weeks ago, essentially supporting the idea of the Mueller report becoming public, you've seen repeated attempts in the Senate, repeated times that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has blocked essentially a resolution that would essentially the same resolution that the House passed just a couple of weeks ago. And the argument that McConnell and Lindsey Graham have given is that let's let the Attorney General do his actual work. He's looking into it right now. He has indicated to Lindsey Graham and Jerry Nadler, the House Judiciary Committee Chairman, that it would be available in weeks, not months. So let's wait and see what he's ready to give us.
Check, BD, I want to read to you a comment from our website. Marcus Six writes, for 2 years, the media has regularly announced how every Trump meeting, every association, tweet, speech, and eye blink showed that he colluded with the Russians. My God, it was tedious. Now this overinflated balloon has probably popped. We still haven't seen the report, Marcus notes. It makes Trump the victim of a biased, angry media. Jack, we saw this argument from the president himself, from the White House. We've seen this argument from his allies on Fox News and also from some on the left who take issue with the way in which American journalists portray Russia and take issue with the way in which American journalists take their cues from, you know, national security officials. How fairly or unfairly has this been framed by the media in its pursuit of this big story over all these months?
Well, I think that there's justice to that critique. I have now read twice this 28-page piece by Matt Taibbi, I believe, of Rolling Stone. It's an excerpt from a book of his in which he indicts the press, not just rhetorically, but with evidence of, at every remove, if there's a call to be made about quote unquote evidence, it always seems to go toward the Trump is guilty of collusion. And he cites, he names names. There are, you know, it ranges from sort of ludicrous claims. He quotes Donna Brazile saying the communists are now dictating the terms of the debate. Of course, the communists have been gone for 30 years. But to particular experts who've been on, Malcolm Nance, who's been a regular,
in some ways it seems as though, Jack,
security person.
Jack, in some ways it seems as though a lot of this critique is intense and in some ways justified, but also, and we don't have a ton of time, but also focus very much on cable news. Is it fair for the larger coverage that's been provided by journalists, you know, major news organizations doing its own reporting?
Well, there have been some embarrassments there, BuzzFeed notably, and we remember that. And rightfully cable. I mean, these people earn their money by whipping up our fears. That goes for Fox, and it certainly goes for MSNBC.
And one reminder, of course, to listeners, since we haven't read the full Mueller report, it's hard to know how justified or unjustified Matt Taibbi is, and yet he raises some interesting issues there. We're talking about the week's biggest news stories. I'd like our guests to stick around. I want you to stick around. I hope you'll join our conversation. What do you hope to see from the Mueller report? What do you think Congress should do about this, if anything? I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're taking a look back at the week's most significant news. You can join our conversation. Republicans and President Trump are attacking the House Democrats' point man on intelligence matters. That's California Congressman Adam Schiff. Which side do you trust? What do you make of Trump's drive to knock out Obamacare and offer a Republican replacement for the healthcare system, as yet unspecified? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Washington Examiner Magazine executive editor Seth Mandel, Washington Post White House reporter Sungmin Kim, and On Point's own news analyst Jack Beattie. I wanted to just read aloud a little bit from a report released this morning, a poll released this morning by NPR in conjunction with the PBS NewsHour and the Marist. It says that one-thirds of Americans believe, based on what they've seen or heard about the Mueller investigation so far, that President Trump is clear of any wrongdoing. 47% think Trump did something either illegal or unethical in his dealings with Putin. And 75% say that the full Mueller report should be made public. Seth Mandel, I want to go back to you, particularly because I think you have your finger on the pulse of a variety of different conservative currents in some interesting ways. You know, we talked a little bit about the question of the media, and there certainly were some big stories the media got wrong, as well as a ton of reporting that helped, I think, advance our knowledge here. Did some of the framing here, did talking about Watergate, as we've done on this show, but as we've seen, you know, in a lot of other coverage, in terms of the ways in which this story was characterized, even in and by reporters and in print, did it raise expectations of something greater than what seemingly has been delivered, at least through what the Attorney General has released so far?
Yeah, I think it raised expectations, and I think it's understandable what happened. I don't think it was crazy to think in terms of Watergate, but I think it threw people off a bit. In other words, Watergate was there were several ways that he could have gotten away with it, and then there were the destruction of tapes, and there were all sorts of drip-drip pieces of information and then mistakes that Nixon himself made. And so I think that people look at Watergate as though you uncover this one grand conspiracy behind a flower pot somewhere, and you know, there's your story, and it brings down the president and whatever. But the truth is that it was all really highly dependent on the way people in the administration acted, what they said, what they took seriously, what they didn't take seriously, and as they say in sports, the breaks of the game. And so I think there's just a sort of heroic narrative of Watergate, which is not exactly accurate, and not what the real live narrative of Watergate really was. And it made people think that, you know, if they just kept turning over stones, they would find the you know, that big story, that holy grail.
I want to turn now to the question of Adam Schiff, whom Republicans have tried to make the issue, and who has been a lead voice for Republicans in for Democrats on Capitol Hill and in the media as well and in public. Republicans have basically started to create a drumbeat of this guy made such strong rhetorical claims about the president, talking about disreputable action. The report's synopsis seems to undercut all that. He should be gone. So during a House Intelligence Committee hearing yesterday, Ohio Republican Congressman Michael Turner compared Adam Schiff to Joseph McCarthy, the famous Wisconsin Republican who basically helped whip up Red Scares in the 1950s. Here's what Congressman Michael Turner had to say.
Mr. Chairman, I'm asking for your resignation today because I believe you are advancing Putin's work. I believe the chair has abused his power in these processes, and he's misrepresenting the information that we've received in classified sessions. Now, Mr. Chairman, when this body understood that McCarthyism was something to be rejected, it for years watched it. But you are using that playbook.
So Adam Schiff forcefully responded yesterday during the congressional hearing to you know, a series of his colleagues saying he'd step down. He said he thought that many of the Trump campaign's actions and many of the president's actions were immoral, unethical, unpatriotic, and corrupt. And he tried to draw a distinction between what was indictable or criminal with what's simply wrong.
I don't think it's okay that during a presidential campaign, Mr. Trump sought the Kremlin's help to consummate a real estate deal in Moscow that would make him a fortune. According to the special counsel, hundreds of millions of dollars. I don't think it's okay that he concealed it from the public. I don't think it's okay that he advocated a new and more favorable policy towards the Russians, even as he was seeking the Russians' help, the Kremlin's help, to make money. I don't think it's okay that his attorney lied to our committee.
Jack Beatty, how compelling, how convincing did you find Adam Schiff's rebuttal?
Well, you know, in the last over the last couple of years, he has been quite an eloquent explainer of elements of the whole collusion question. But I think there is justice. At least I feel this as somebody who watches the news. There is justice to the complaint that he has perhaps we don't know that he has, you know, maybe misrepresented things they heard in camera, maybe not. But he has again and again said, I have heard him say, there has been collusion. We have, well, really, I understand there's a political competition here, but he, you know, for all his lucidity and his command of the facts, he has pushed again and again this notion of, if you knew what I knew, because I'm hearing, you know, things in secret, if you knew what I knew, you'd know that this man, I think there's justice to the Republican attack.
And Sung Min, how's Schiff standing on Capitol Hill? How are House Democratic leaders responding to all this?
Well, Nancy Pelosi was asked about this yesterday, and she is still very much supportive of him. Adam Schiff does have the support of House Democrats. So at least among his party, he's not going anywhere. Clearly, this is a rhetorical fight that the Republicans and the president are happy to have. But this is something that you're going to be hearing, especially from the president, over the next several weeks, for a very long time. And you got a preview last night of how he's just going to weaponize the findings of the Mueller report at his rally last night in Michigan. And Adam Schiff, who the president singled out again and, you know, kind of made comments about his appearance and whatnot, is going to be a big part of that attack. I thought it was very stunning and very notable that all of the House Republicans on the Intelligence Committee called for the chairman's resignation. Now, obviously, over the last couple of years, we've seen just how tense and partisan that committee has become, but which is actually hasn't been the case in Congress. Usually the intelligence committees are bipartisan affairs. Certainly the Senate Intelligence Committee under the leadership of Richard Burr and Mark Warner have been working on a bipartisan manner on investigating Russian interference in the elections. But clearly Adam Schiff's standing, and that is just getting very contentious on Capitol Hill. He's been mentioned as a potential successor to Nancy Pelosi as speaker in the past, and we'll just wait and see what happens, particularly as we see more and more from the Mueller report.
I think it's pretty fair to say anyway that, you know, his Republican predecessor, Devin Nunes, was seen as sort of acting as an adjunct of the Trump White House, playing defense, right? You know, when he was running the committee in the last year or two.
Yeah, and that was part of one of the reasons why just in the last couple of years there has been this very partisan tinge to the House Intelligence Committee, which again has been such a contrast from how things have been and also how things have been in the Senate.
Seth Mandel, I did want to ask, you know, there's an element of all this that's fascinating because it teases out, you know, I talked to journalists this week about this, and some of the most experienced ones said, you know, Marty Baron said this to others, Bill Gruskin, the former one of the top editors of the Wall Street Journal, said this to me. There's a distinction between what's newsworthy and what is shocking and what is perhaps politically actionable on Capitol Hill, and what, you know, an experienced prosecutor like Robert Mueller might want to think is indictable. That's a subtle distinction, right, to be made. Is this the sort of thing that is appropriate in your mind for people to take up on the Hill, or is this something where it said, you know what, as long as we see the report, we'll have an understanding of what happened, and unless there's some true criminality, we need to move on?
I think that it's certainly legitimate to have action on the Hill on this stuff, and the point about what's actionable and not, this is the key point that I think a lot of people actually forgot, which is that impeachment itself is a political act. It's not right. You know, it's not a matter of law and order, and so it certainly looked, Congress has oversight responsibilities and they will execute those responsibilities. In this case, I think that we should see the Mueller report, although I imagine that there are notes here and there that probably need to be redacted, but barring those, because this is really technically a counterintelligence investigation into the president of the United States, so there are likely to be things that the whole country shouldn't just open the newspaper and see, but those are probably minimal, and I think that we should see the report, and then judging what action Democrats in Congress and on the committees take up will matter greatly, and, you know, will depend greatly on what we see in the report. It's possible that the report answers the questions that we have, and since we've already had the investigations and we've already had several indictments and other cases being referred to the Southern District of New York, it might be that the report shows that it's time to wrap it up. But it's possible that there are loose ends that would fall under the purview of Congress. And for that, it would not be inappropriate if something falls under their purview just because we're tired of hearing about the Russia story. If something is you know, within their rights to do as the oversight body, then, you know, we've got to let them do it.
And to correct something I said earlier, I want to be clear. The NPR PBS Marist poll said that 57% of Americans now think Trump did something either illegal or unethical in his dealings with Putin and Russia. I want to now take a couple of quick calls. Charles is calling from Tampa, Florida. Charles, what do you think about all this?
Hi. I want to say very briefly, because I know others are trying to get in, I think the Mueller investigation should be released completely. If there's nothing to hide, then release it. Secondly, I don't think that Donald Trump is the victim of anything when it comes to the media. He has attacked the media viciously. He takes credit for a lot of things that he shouldn't be taking credit for, and he doesn't take responsibility for anything. And those rallies he's holding, unfortunately, the vast majority of those people come from a particular ethnic group in this country, so they don't represent the broad array of Americans. They represent large segments of Anglo-America who support Donald Trump and his policies. I believe that there is something else to be uncovered, and I think we should let this process unfold itself and get the partisanship out of it, the meanness out of it, and the truth is in the pudding. The proof is in the pudding. If Trump is going to be a successful president that's going to help the American people, that remains to be seen. But in the end, we look at the results, and I think the Mueller report needs to be released because if there's nothing to hide, then let it be.
Thank you for that, Charles. I'd like to take another call now from New Orleans. Veronica, tell us what you're thinking about this.
Hi, David. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to ask if it's really fair to say that it was unjustified for the media to portray the president a certain way when there have been so many indictments and a lot of people facing jail time. How is it then unjustified to say that the president is also accountable for some of his actions?
That's an interesting question. There have been a couple dozen indictments, indeed, Veronica, a lot of them of Russians, but also of people who were close to him for not collusion per se, but for criminal offenses. Thanks so much for your call. I want to turn now to another action that the president taped. He's been on a victory lap. He's been very happy. The president is now saying that he's going to keep promises. He is doubling and tripling down on his pledge that the Republicans would revisit the Affordable Care Act. He's called Obamacare a disaster and said that Republicans will henceforth be known as the party of health care. And in a legal filing just this past Monday, the Justice Department argued that Obamacare should be utterly invalidated. Here's Trump last night at his rally in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
We believe that no one in America should be bankrupted by health care costs, and that's what's happening with Obamacare. And remember this, because it's very important. And I'm speaking now for the Republican Party. We will always protect patients with pre-existing conditions. Always. Always.
Subsequent news reports say that Trump's Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, and his Attorney General, again, Bill Barr, have argued against backing the lawsuit for that full repeal. Sungmin, how's this playing with his fellow Republicans?
His fellow Republicans, most of them aren't quite too pleased with his new health care push. Well, first of all, they would have preferred that the president kind of enjoy the news of the initial findings of the Mueller report, at least for another 24 hours than he perhaps did. But look, Republicans have clearly struggled to coalesce around one single health care plan that can pass Congress, that could be signed by the president, and live up to the promises that Republicans have made in terms of protecting people with pre-existing conditions. I mean, I think that obviously with the House being in Democratic control, the prospects for legislation are very, very low at this point. The president did say yesterday that he has tapped a trio of senators, Republican senators, to kind of craft an Obamacare replacement. These are senators, John Barrasso, Bill Cassidy, Rick Scott, who are either physicians or have experience in the healthcare industry. But Mitch McConnell has made it clear in private that this is not something that he wants to embark on, because politically speaking, he knows this is something that is incredibly difficult for the party. Public polling shows that the public does favor Democrats when it comes to the issue of health care. It was clearly a major part of why Democrats were able to win back control of the House. If you ask particularly Republican senators who are up for re-election next year in purple or blue states, and ask them about the DOJ filing that said essentially the entire Affordable Care Act should be thrown out, they will either not answer or say they were very disappointed in the DOJ's analysis. So I think unless there is a forcing mechanism in some way, and I'm thinking perhaps if the law is eventually struck down by the Supreme Court, that would force Republicans into action and force Congress into action, excuse me. But obviously, any ruling at the Supreme Court on this case is very far away. It is in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals right now. So this is by no means something that is definite or imminent at this point.
So, Sungmin, we only have a couple seconds left before this. But why is he doing it then?
It's his one big unfulfilled campaign promise. You know, he's pushed on the wall. He's cut taxes. He's rolled back regulations. But this has just eluded him since 2017. So he will fixate on it for months to come.
We're discussing the past week in the news. You can join our conversation. It's Infrastructure Week, at least for Senator Amy Klobuchar. What do you make of the 2020 Democrats' big policy ideas? What about that prosecutorial 180 from Chicago's chief prosecutors regarding Jussie Smollett? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunha was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're talking about a big week in the news. Follow us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Washington Examiner magazine executive editor Seth Mandel, Washington Post White House reporter Sungmin Kim, and our own On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Just to kick us off, I wanted to mention, you know, NASA's unexpected wardrobe malfunction. NASA was expecting to have the first all-female spacewalk. Astronaut Anne McLean, as the AP reports, was supposed to float out of the International Space Station today with newly arrived Christina Koch, to replace old batteries. But McLean pulled herself from the lineup. There's not enough time, apparently, for them to get two medium-sized suits ready for them. It would have taken 12 hours to get another medium spacesuit ready, and that would have potentially compromised safety, according to a NASA spokeswoman. These spacewalks are months late, and with cargo deliveries coming up, NASA wants to keep everything on track, but I guess gender parity has not yet reached the celestial heavens. I want to turn now to the question of the 2020 Democratic field and policy. I think it's interesting that, you know, there's been a lot of criticism of, say, Beto O'Rourke for a question of whether or not he's substantive. And yet there are a number of folks out there who seem to really bring some policy matters into sharp focus about what they want to do. We've lately had Kamala Harris talk about teacher pay, that she would increase, I guess, the state taxes in order to really raise teacher salaries around the country. And also there's the question of Amy Klobuchar has been talking about the need to invest significantly in infrastructure. Sungmin Kim, what do you see in terms of the Democrats? Why this early are they staking out significant policies? Or in looking at the details, is there really all that much there?
Well, I think in terms of policy, if you look at the type of questions that they're getting at town halls from voters in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, all these early states, they are getting a lot of questions about policy and issues and what would you do on healthcare, drug policy, teacher pay, things like that. So I think they're trying to present those answers to the Democratic base as early as they can. And also because there are so many of them running in the primary, and obviously more to come in the coming weeks and months, they are finding ways to distinguish themselves in terms of what kind of policy lane that they seize. I think that obviously Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have been really leading kind of on the ideas front. Elizabeth Warren, especially, she seems to be rolling out one big policy idea very frequently. But it's really interesting to see what these Democratic candidates choose as perhaps their first issue to really make their mark on, or as their signature issue. I mean, Amy Klobuchar, she does have this, she's trying to go for this very, I can reach across the aisle. I've worked with Republicans. Infrastructure is the classic bipartisan issue, even if it doesn't seem to have much of a chance on Capitol Hill right now. I mean, once, you know, if you think of something that everybody agrees on, it's the idea that you have to improve the nation's roads and bridges. So I think that kind of fits her profile that she's trying to present to voters. I also thought Kamala Harris's choosing teacher pay as her first kind of big campaign issue was also really interesting as well. Obviously, has gotten a great feedback from Democratic voters. This is something that is broadly popular. She's laid out the details on how she would pay for it by increasing the estate tax and closing some tax loopholes. Obviously, that is something that would go over well with Democratic voters. But I will say, having watched Kamala Harris on Capitol Hill for the last couple of years since she became a senator, I feel her signature issue on Capitol Hill so far has been immigration. She's been really aggressive and vocal in defending Dreamers, in fighting against this administration's immigration policies. She was one of the ones who actually voted against John Kelly for the Department of Homeland Security Secretary essentially the day that the president was inaugurated because of the immigration issue. So the fact that she's choosing a different issue as kind of her first campaign policy issue was interesting for me to watch.
Seth Mandel, as you look at what the Democrats are offering the public, what does it say to you about the strength of the Democratic field, and what does it say to you about the direction of the party?
Well, they can't – if there's going to be 17 candidates, right, you can't all run on Russia and Trump and say the same thing. So I think that they have to distinguish themselves. Sungmin is right, and I think also that means – vying for support from teachers' unions and other interest groups like that earlier on, because there's going to be a real competition, which is what I think you're seeing with Kamala Harris's teacher pay plan. I will say that as a former New Jersey Transit commuter daily into Manhattan,
I've seen your tweets on this.
It is always infrastructure week in the Mandel household. So I look at Amy Klobuchar's plan with great interest. I think that, you know, Sungmin said it as well, that this is the great bipartisan issue. But this is also something that actually Donald Trump theoretically understands and would want as well, coming from New York. You have a president from New York. You have the Democrats' Senate floor leader is Chuck Schumer, is from New York. You have a very New York-y sort of leadership there. And I think that they all understand this. So it's frustrating that they haven't moved on it. But I think that Amy Klobuchar's plan is, look, it's ambitious. And so I think that's one thing that it tells you about Democrats for 2020, is that they want to be seen as ambitious. They're not going to do anything halfway. And you're seeing that with the Green New Deal. That is an ambitious version of a climate plan. And Senator Klobuchar's infrastructure plan is definitely ambitious, so ambitious that I think she wants to pay for it by raising corporate taxes. And her argument is that, look, if the Democrats win the election, then it means we're going to also have control of the Senate probably, and then we can pass some tax. I don't think that they're going to be able to roll back the tax cuts. I think that's kind of pie in the sky. And so I think paying for it is a difficult question. But at the same time, when you talk about the value of infrastructure to the nation, when you talk about these main arteries of economic of the centers of American finance and economic that are clogged, you also understand that you can, you know, you spend money on the surgery, right, to unclog those arteries, and that there are benefits down the line. And so that strikes me as maybe more reasonable than just either the Green New Deal or let's just raise teacher pay by lots of money.
Mm-hmm. And thanks for the corrective on which tax it was involved. Of course you can, Jack. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, there was one candidate this week who I think did not distinguish himself, and that is Bernie Sanders. The House Democrats came out with a bill that would patch up some of the holes in Obamacare, that would broaden coverage. Paul Krugman in Today's Times said it might even increase coverage for a score million more people, and would give subsidies to the middle class, more subsidies to the poor, to deal with these, you know, tremendous premiums people are paying. Bernie Sanders said he was against it. Why? Because he says, I've been voting for, I'm not going to go with these incremental changes anymore. I want my plan. I want, you know, the clean slate. I want to begin again. You know, that's a position that will students will find from of revolutionary movements will find familiar. The Marxists call it intensify the contradictions. You know, they don't want to intervene in anything to make something better, because it's the feeling that things are hopeless that will contribute to the let's have Bernie care, let's have a complete upheaval in health care. And it was going to be the Democrats, really, I think, crucible in the campaign. The Republicans are going to say, Bernie wants to take health care away from 100 plus million people and substitute for it. Well, he'll tell you. Now, of course, that Mr. Trump has stepped in it with this position on Obamacare, the Democrats have an issue to say, no, it's Trump. He wants to take pre-existing conditions away from 113 million people. So Bernie is against incremental reform. And I think, you know, you got to take that on board. This could improve the lives of the people he claims to represent, the poor, the hardworking wage earner, the strapped middle class earner. And Bernie says, nope, I don't want that. I want the whole thing.
We're going to take a call now from Charleston, South Carolina. Sarah, thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for answering my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to call. I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter, and a week and a half ago, he had a rally here in Charleston, and Medicare for All was his main issue that he discussed at the rally. So mm-hmm. I don't find it surprising what Jack just discussed about him saying he's against incremental changes, because he's made it very clear at his rally and in his policy statements in general that he wants to reform the system, because the system's not working. Even with the Affordable Care Act, the system's not working. Mm-hmm. So I think that Bernie has the right idea. And also, it's important to remember that he has been one of the most popular politicians in the country since 2018. People need to factor that in when they're thinking about who's going to be able to beat Trump.
Well, thank you for that, Sarah. I appreciate that that contribution there. It's interesting to hear from what it's like in seeing Sanders on the ground there in South Carolina, of course, one of the earliest states. Thanks for that call. I want to share with listeners also an issue we've been tracking over these many months and even last few years. News that the latest Brexit vote went down in defeat, what they're calling a Brexit 3.0, that is the latest iteration of how England could leave the European Union on less than calamitous terms. Prime Minister Theresa May says implications are grave. She's lost badly by some, call it 60 votes in Parliament. Currently, the Wall Street Journal reporting the vote pushes the country closer to a constitutional crisis. Britain has, according to USA Today, until April 12th to announce a new plan or to leave the European Union, the trading bloc, which is integrated itself with in so many ways, without any deal whatsoever. And it's a real moment for Britain, where basically Parliament's backbenchers, that is to say not the leaders of the major parties, are going to have to figure out a way to cobble some understanding. Do they put this back to a vote? Do they crash out of the European Union? What's going to happen? This is something that we will be, as I promised, continuing to follow here on On Point and on NPR. I want to head over to what's been happening in Chicago. Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson spoke to reporters this week after prosecutors dropped all charges against the actor Jussie Smollett.
If you want to say you're innocent of a situation, then you take your day in court. I would never, if someone falsely accused me, I would never hide behind a brokered deal in secrecy, period.
Seth Mandel, a lot of issues have been raised over in Chicago about whether or not somebody wealthy, whether or not somebody famous has been able to have charges against him expunged. He had, of course, raised allegations that he had been attacked in a hate crime, suggested that, MAGA hat wielding Trump fans had sometimes attacked him. He is an African-American. He is a gay actor on the Fox hit show Empire. It now appears that that was not the case. And there are real questions about how this was handled. We heard at the top of the hour from the mayor, Rahm Emanuel. What lessons do you take from this? What certainties do you feel you have at this point?
The lessons that I take away from this are that politicians will generally look at a situation and say, I need this like I need a hole in the head. And I think that drove – it strikes me that that drove a lot of the reaction to this, which is that you can basically argue, I think convincingly, that this is a victimless crime, the hate crime hoax. And so I think from Chicago's perspective, you can understand from a political perspective why drag this out, why make a whole big thing. Maybe let's just give him community service and a fine or something like that and wrap it up and make it go away. And I think that what you're actually seeing is the nationalization of politics. There really isn't anything now that happens that isn't that isn't immediately broadcasted from a bullhorn to the rest of the country, and the rest of the country dives in. And so you have local interests, competing interests. Law enforcement wants to show maybe that there's no double standard or there's no two-tiered law. The politicians kind of want it to go away, but you can't in this day and age of 24/7 media and social media, you almost really can't force anything to go away. And so, they're being pulled by the tide, and it's not just a Chicago case anymore, even though they're the ones that are going to decide it. It gets nationalized. And so now you have calls for the feds to get involved also and to try to sort this out. And so it's the nationalization of everything. And of course, there's a reason for that, which is that it gets folded into a grander narrative, competing narratives of right. Are hate crimes on the rise or are hate crime hoaxes on the rise? And if both are true, is one a bigger problem than the other? And this has become a real partisan issue. And so it's not the sort of thing that the public is letting them sweep under the rug.
As we close out the hour, I want to take a quick call from Milwaukee, Wisconsin on this very topic. Mike, go ahead.
Hi, David.
Hi.
Yeah, I just think it's important that people don't jump to a conclusion about why they decided not to prosecute. Those decisions are complex, and as was indicated by your guest, sometimes they're political, but there also needs to be confidence in elected officials in making those types of decisions. So until people get the full gamut of information that might be available down the road, it's probably a good idea to not conclude that this was either a slam dunk case that simply was dropped because he's a celebrity. It may be that there are other issues at play, and that kind of information doesn't always pop into the media headlights, and that's a loss.
Well, thank you for that, Mike. A good point always to underscore about not jumping to conclusions about our top story of the hour and the story here wrapping it up. Worth noting, of course, prosecutors in Chicago say don't take it to be an exoneration, a phrase that we heard a little echo of in apparently the summation of the Mueller report. We've been listening this hour with gratitude to Sungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Always so glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Seth Mandel, executive editor of The Washington Examiner magazine. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, David.
And of course, On Point's own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, have a great weekend.
Thank you, David.
You can continue our conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I hope you will. We've got a newsletter there for you. We're produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Down, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Adam Waller, with help from Matt Hoish and Alex Pena. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Believe it or not, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title, and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.